I want to thank Mary for inviting me, and Greg, and David Wojon, and everyone else associated with VCU. I've had a wonderful day. I'm going to do something that I normally don't do. I'm going to start with sort of older work and then end with newer work. So I'll get the really depressing poems out of the way first and then end with the mildly depressing poems at the end. I'm going to read from Song and Dance, which is a book-length elegy from my brother David, who was an actor, song and dance man. Last big credit was Sunset Boulevard on Broadway with Glenn Close. He died of brain cancer in 1999. And the book is both an homage to him and his resiliency and courage, and also a kind of inquiry into the limits of art in dealing with the catastrophic loss. The Song and Dance, the title, refers both to the fact that my brother was a song and dance man, and also draws on the pejorative expression, "Don't give me a song and dance, you know, don't try to pull a fast one on me." The book is both situated in the English elegiac tradition, which offers consolation for loss, and also tries to define itself against that tradition, since there is no adequate compensation for the loss of a loved one, and no monument or poem can substitute for the person that we love. So in a way, the deep assumption behind the book is that the only good poetry is poetry that could literally raise someone from the dead. And if it can't do that, it has to at least acknowledge its woeful inadequacy, whatever else it may do or fail to do. The first poem in the book is called Everything the Traffic Will Allow. Some of you in the audience know something about show business will recognize that phrase from an Ethel Merman song, "There's No Business Like Show Business." And it is inspired by one of my fondest memories of my childhood, which is my brother and I, before we would go to bed, lip-syncing to Ethel Merman's "No Business Like Show Business" to our parents before we would go to bed. And so it's just as a poem that draws on that memory. It's called Everything the Traffic Will Allow. The two boys don't suspect, they don't exist. And Ethel Merman is the shade of a shade. What Plato says all poetry is, a record spinning beneath a needle. As the boys lip sync into imaginary mics, her glottal swagger, brassy, large, streetwise, and from their mouths, so touchingly naive for being so. There's no people like show people. Their parents clap and whistle from the bed, propped up on pillows. Everything about it is appealing. They are shouting encore, bravo, when the boys, like chorus girls, arms on each other's shoulders, step kick their way across the room and out of it, then back, stealing that extra bow. Shades of a shade. What poetry is, because there's nowhere else for them to be except inside the room in which it isn't when it is, in which there is no room unless I think of it. The boys, their arms flung wide on one knee, mouthing the last words before the needle slides off into silence. The parents propped up on pillows, half laughing, half shouting, bravo, encore, all now just the shade of a shade, like no people I know. The book conducts a kind of argument with the literary tradition, as I alluded to before. Some of my favorite poets have written in consoling terms about death, consoling terms that now, in the light of the particular losses that I've experienced, seem, if not like total bullshit, pretty close to it. So the next poem is sort of an argument, respectful argument, with Emily Dickinson, Walt Whitman, and Wallace Stevens, three of my favorite poets. Wallace Stevens, of course, who said that death is the mother of beauty. Walt Whitman, in Crossing the Brooklyn Ferry, said that based on time avails not, death avails not. And Emily Dickinson, who has written both despairingly and consolingly about death, but she also has a very famous poem about a hummingbird. And the occasion of this poem is of a hummingbird suddenly appearing to me on the front porch of a house I lived in. and making me think of Emily Dickinson and making me think of Whitman and Stevens while in another state, in another place, some terrible things are happening to my brother that would qualify, if not contradict, the kind of solace that I was taking from being able to remember these particular poems. The poem is called The Accident, and again, it begins with a description of a hummingbird. While it was happening, the absolute not me of it, the all of a sudden see-through whir of wings beside me that the late sun, just as I looked up, turned to a hovering flash, a watery gray-green iridescence as the beak dipped into a funnel of blossom, dipped and was gone, and not even the blossom's white tip bent in its going or shivered. While this, which could have happened without me, here or elsewhere, happened the way it did and would continue happening for others, for no one, for nothing but the blind urge of its happening, this ever-transient, accidental crossing of momentums that was, in this case, beautiful, but could have not been, and so seemed all the more consoling for the thought. Even the thought of death just then consoling, shaping itself inside me as the now there, now not there, hovering of bird, flower, late sun iridescences. Beloved singers, you who in the aftermath surged from the shadows to sing in your different voices the same song, root of evanescence, mother of beauty, it avails not, time nor place, distance avails not. If you had known just then, 300 miles away in another state, that one of the nurses getting my brother up from the commode and back to bed, the one who held him on his left side, the dead side, all of a sudden lost hold of him and as he fell hard, grabbed for the loose papery gown and ripped it off, so that he lay there naked, utterly exposed. Beloved singers, tricksters of solace, if you had known this, seen this, as I did not, you would have offered him no sumptuous destitution, no fire-fangled feathers or blab about death as being luckier than one supposes. You would have bowed your heads. You would have silently slipped back into the shadows out of which you surged forth, singing to me. Next poem is called Joy, and it draws on, inspired partly by West Side Story, Maria's song, I Feel Pretty, which my daughter is singing to me on the day that I leave home to keep the final vigil at my brother's bedside. The poem is called Joy. It's also inspired by some of those National Geographic movies of lions hunting antelopes, aerial views of antelope herds running away from attacking lions. It's called Joy. And the poem is sort of a series of metaphors for joy. Joy. What never comes when called. What hides when held. Guest most at home where least expected. Vagrant balm of Gilead. What soon as here becomes the body's native ground, and soon as not, its banishment. Coming and going, indifferent, magisterial. My lovely daughter walking me to the car to say goodbye the day I left to keep watch at my brother's bedside, suddenly singing, I feel pretty, oh so pretty, as she raised her arms up in a loose oval over her head and pirouetted all along the walk. Savage and magisterial, the joy of it, the animal candor of each arabesque, each leaping turn and counter-turn, her voice now wobbly with laughter, and I pity any girl who isn't me tonight. Savagely beautiful, not so much like the lion that the camera freezes in mid-pounce, claws outstretched for the stumbling antelope, as like the herd escaping that the camera pans to, zigzagging, swerving as one, their leaping strides now leaping higher, faster, even after it seems the fear subsides, after the fear and the relief, they keep on running for nothing but the joy of running, though it could be any one of them is running from its fallen mother or father, sister or brother, across the wide savanna under a bright sun into fresher grass. A poem I'll read from this book is called To the Body. It's an ode to the body, about the way in which, of course, it's impossible to imagine any mode of existence without the body. And the poem is an address to the body, a series of metaphors for a body, and then it moves into a kind of narrative. There are also some quotations, particularly of a poem by John Milton, famous sonnet of his, "Methinks I saw my late espoused saint," in which he has this dream of seeing his dead wife, and there's a line, "But oh, as to embrace me she inclined." And I think that's all you really need to know. Just to try to sort of inhabit a series of metaphors about what it means to have a body and to be a body. And I, playing with that notion of having a body and being the body that you have, which, so anyway, it's called To the Body. Mutable port of entry, port of call, cargo and ship. Where can we go without you? Where can we be? Anarchic borderland patrolled by piercing, tattoo, shawl, veil, collar, earlock, and dreadlock. Ventriloquist of genes, vector of history. The agonizing stage on which the anorexic girl performs clay, dreaming spirit, dreaming clay. At one and the same time, pleasure dome and torture chamber, prisoner and cell wall through which the prisoner taps out a message to the prisoner in the next cell, who taps his message back through the wall that's separating links. Even the gods and the dead are inconceivable without you, white-vested specter, tenuous air. But oh, as to embrace me, she inclined. Oh, bosom of Abraham, the whole world in his hands, propitiations and provisions all assume you. Wine jars, jewels, and honey cakes, baubles and trinkets in the Sun King's tomb. My addle-brained Aunt Tilly sang after the funeral that she just couldn't let them close the casket till she'd placed a golf ball in her husband's hand, because my Amos, you know, he always had such a thing for golf. And yes, I mocked her. What did I know about you then? I whispered in my brother's ear, thank God he didn't have a thing for cottage cheese. I mocked her, and you took your own sweet time to get revenge nearly three decades later, when I saw how the embalmers had slicked back my brother's hair, and it wasn't him. It just wasn't him, and I too wouldn't let them close the casket till I tried to palm the hair down over his forehead the way he kept it, as if the frigid skin would somehow thereby become less frigid if I got it right. Death's feed bag, mother load of yearning, salve and sore. Even the worst there is to suffer seems in my ignorance of it to be no less precious. And though it does no good to ask you this, I ask it anyway. Keep me and those I love with you in safety for a long time yet. Steer clear of the hidden reef you also are, who are at once the fire eating the wood, and the wood that burning eats the fire. I have a new book coming out in April called Tantalus in Love. This is what it looks like, a little bit cheerier than my other covers. I'm going to read three poems from this book. First poem is called Space Dog, and then late 1950s, the Soviets sent up a rocket ship into space with a dog in it, a dog called Laika, and they just wanted to see how long a dog would survive in space before it died. So they raised this dog, fed it, treated it with loving kindness, and then put it in a rocket ship and sent it out without any intention of bringing it back. I remember seeing pictures of Laika when I was a kid, both photographs of Laika was a border collie, and then also seeing cartoons of Laika. Always seemed to me a perfect metaphor for child rearing. This is a poem that's inspired by seeing a 13-year-old boy in front of a mirror, a boy whose body is changing, becoming an adolescent, and being a little bit sort of fascinated and as well as confused by the changes taking place in his body. It's called Space Dog. As if amazed, it's his. He holds his hand up before the mirror, hand too big now for the boy's body. Hand he's turning slowly front to back to front, then closes to a fist he just as slowly opens like an exotic flower to its full extent. The boy, so newly merged with the emerging man, it's hard to say what's boy or man, but for the eyes, the boyish, rapt confusion in the look he looks with at his mobile features as he draws a blunt finger over the shadow of hair along his upper lip. Shadow of hair in armpit, crotch, voice deeper than it was, then higher, deeper, while the eyes, astounded, furtive, are the eyes of someone who cannot quite wake up from the dream in which he suddenly discovers he is naked among a crowd of strangers. Or like the eyes of Laika, Soviet space dog in an old drawing I remember, the stunned, not yet distrusting, but no longer trusting, look from within the comical glass bubble of the gawky helmet tilted atop the comical white spacesuit as the spaceship hurtles out toward the stars, the Earth a star behind it, the earnest dog eyes fixed on black space like a door the masters have walked through and will return from. Surely, surely they'll come to get me. Surely they didn't love me all that time for this. This is a little bit longer of a poem, a little narrative poem called Super Bowl Party. And it's just about a lot of different overlapping histories that happen, of course, when you fall in love in your middle ages. It's called Super Bowl Party. Under the street lamp, cars glistened end to end, clogging the cul-de-sac and driveway, and even the front yard of the small house, whose windows were shadowy with friends you wanted me to meet. And in the house, the game glowed from the big screen, and we, in different phases of our middle age, milled about it, drinks in hand, watching, not watching, drifting from small talk to smaller talk, eyes shifting from the changed formations, the timing routes, the thud of impact, to whomever it was we talked with, and then beyond them, slyly, now and again, to others in the room whose eyes were just as slyly glancing at us without appearing to. The game glowed from another, smaller screen in the bright kitchen where Anne, your dearest friend with MS, who'd broken up with Tim the week before because he drank too much and she was sick of it, was fixing him a drink. And where the beautiful gaunt woman with high cheekbones that were higher, more beautiful for the gauntness, the bald head, leaned against her husband through the evening under the blunt lighting she must have surely felt too looked at in. For hadn't there been rumors of a brief affair, his moving out, then in again when she got sick, so that it almost seemed their every gesture of affection and solicitude, which all of us found so touching, could have been not only a late imperiled flowering of old devotion, but defiance too, of us, of what they knew we knew, the very ones they charmed all evening, leaning her head against his chest, his hand all evening on her shoulders. The game glowed from the big screen. The underdogs were running up the score. My eyes were shifting from the adjustments, the audibles, the cutback moves, to you in what phase of desire, what entangling shadows, seeing for the first time in years the ex who cheated on you and deceived you and who now was joking with the very man you briefly left him for before his change of heart that just as soon as you returned. What shadowy hunger of what understory of relation on the periphery of your attention kept you silent even when the streaker streaked across the field and held up play as someone beside us muttered, "That's as close to scoring as we're going to get." Thicket of phases, unspoken relations of our middle age, the game glowed nearly over. We didn't know Anne had disappeared with Tim into the bedroom till she, flushed and laughing in a silver and black dress in honor of the losing team, emerged unsteadily, drink in one hand, the other holding onto Tim's sleeve. And if you wondered why she hadn't warned you that your ex would be there, if you thought in her unhappiness she might have grudged you this new happiness with me, despite her love for you, because of it, you wouldn't say. And I, too, could not have told the difference then between affection and a demonstration of affection, affection as defiance or revenge or courtesy, when in full view of him, you put your arm around me, leaned your head against my shoulder, and whooped and cheered more loudly than the others, as Anne, clinging to Tim with one hand, drink raised in the other to the losing team, paraded giddily from living room to kitchen, back to living room in that halting, brave, toddler, half-step way of hers that all of us have lately noticed getting so much worse. One more poem from this book and then a couple of new poems and then I'll finish up. No poetry reading should be complete without a poem about phone sex. So here goes, premonition. Two lovers talking on the phone at night, ear pressed to the receiver, pressed to ear, for the half-whispering voices that are clearer for being quiet, more intimate somehow for being far away. The timbre, pitch, and exact inflection of who they are in saying what they want, what they would do if they were there together, has never been so audible, as if the sheer voice stripped of body were revealing something about the nature of their love, not just for bodies, but of his body for hers and hers for his. The lovers never more exactly there, though less material, never more held, more truly clung to than in separation. I wish I could take you in my mouth right now. I wish your lips were here. The voice is hungry, ghost-like, and won't it be like this one day? Only the voice returning to the stark bed, voice rising up from where nobody rises, your voice or mine, to haunt us as tonight our voices haunt the hand that moves like the lips that speak the words of what the lips would do. Just a few more poems. I overheard a remark in a Chinese restaurant many years ago that we were talking today in the class, the graduate students that I met with, about how do you keep poems from being too personal or merely confessional or merely anecdotal. And I had this line, I had overheard somebody say this line that you will hear in this next poem 30 years ago, and I always wanted to get into a poem and couldn't figure out how to do it for years and years. And in fact, it had been in different poems that weren't very good, and then I finally found a place for it. I think that's all you need to know. It's called Egg Rolls, and it's about a couple overhearing another couple having a little marital spat. Egg Rolls. The gregarious babble muffled the sharp words the couple in the next booth were trying all through dinner not to have. Only an occasional, "No, you listen for a change," or "How dare you?" or "I can't believe this," would rise above the barely suppressed, staccato, "Please God, not now, not here," rhythm of an argument they wanted both to swallow and spit out. Then the pause, the momentary silence in which the whole place seemed to be listening to the woman say at last, clearly and slowly so everyone could hear, "It's not the egg rolls, Harry. It's the last 10 years. Oh, Harry. Can you forgive them, the young couple in the next booth who laughed out loud, but really did try not to? Surely you heard them. How could you not have, as you ran past, hurrying after her, your disappearing wife? And though it's nearly 30 years since then, would it console you now to learn they didn't last a year, that couple? And even that night, although they strolled home hand in hand, a little less estranged for all the laughter you occasioned, even after making love and meaning it and lying back, no part of either of them touching now, they heard, they couldn't help but lie there wide awake and hear, the couple from the next apartment, who for all they knew could have been you and her, go at it longer, louder, deeper into the night than they themselves had ever thought was possible. This is called 50s Dance, and it's about being at a dance, most of the dancers being 50-something, not necessarily listening to 50s music. It's called the 50s Dance. We're dancing near the stage when she notices me noticing her staring at the lead singer. She smiles and says, "He looks like Jay, the ex-lover Clint Eastwood twin." Her tone so casual, I can't help think it isn't. So I say, "You mean the Barry Manilow look-alike?" And she says, "Yeah, right," meaning, "Whatever you say, dear," as her eyes take in again the tall physique, the loose blouse and pajama bottoms, the rugged face, more rugged somehow for the graying ponytail and soft voice, soft but clear but ardent, singing, "Wandering in the daylight, searching for you with a flashlight." I pull her close. I ask, "But seriously, if you'd been more available, you'd have stayed with that guy, right?" She says, "You mean if he'd been a different person?" Spinning away till I draw her back to ask what comes out as a statement. "But if not for that, he'd have been your ideal man," meaning in bed, his body. And she says, smiling, patting my cheek, "No, honey, I married you, didn't I? You're the sexiest man I've ever been with." The compliment itself a complicated dance of irony and affection. Doo-wop of late passion, as is the thumbs up I smiling offer in return. And the laugh, we laugh then, grateful and edgy, too knowing not to be, yet fresher for what it knows, and stranger too. And as we dance, I lip sync to the singer who I am and am not mocking now, my head thrown back like his, my eyes like his, half closed. Better to see in daylight with a flashlight how her eyes could fix on mine, on me, unable ever to tear themselves away. I'm going to read two more poems. The first one is sort of a prose poem. I actually got asked by Alan King, the late comedian who died just a few months ago, put together a book called Matzo Balls for Breakfast on growing up Jewish, and he asked a bunch of writers and celebrities to offer their reminiscences of growing up Jewish, and so this is what I came up with, and it's like it's more like a little short story than a prose poem, but I'm call it a prose poem. It's called Listen. I'm facing my mother in the cramped living room of her small apartment in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. She and my father have recently moved here from California. She's 80, he's 87. He with his Parkinson's and macular degeneration, she with terrible arthritis in her back and hands. They have started over in a new place where, aside from me and my wife and kids, they do not know a soul. As my mother explains it to her few remaining friends and family, they didn't want me having to traipse across the continent to care for them every time something happened. Better for me to have them living here. She struggled up out of her recliner, panting from the effort, and has handed me the list of groceries I should get if it's not too much trouble. "Wait," she says as I turn to go, "wait, use my car, let it be on my nickel." I tell her no, I'd rather use my own. Her radio's on the blink. "Take the key," she says, "take. How far do you have to go that you have to listen?" The question pulls me up short, disorients me, thrills and annoys me all at once. It's not just the tinge of Yiddish in the syntax, but also the stubbornness masquerading as request, the double exposure in the tone of generosity and distrust, of pride and need, that suddenly conjures out of thin air the kitchen table in the old house in Brookline, Massachusetts, where the elder sat and kibitzed. I could be 10 years old again, or 5, or even younger, too young to count as company, absorbing, without quite knowing that I am, the secondhand smoke of their inflections and intonations. I say it over to myself, "How far do you have to go that you have to listen?" I hum it, I chant it like a mantra, as if it were itself the music of my childhood, the verbal key to an immigrant culture that's nearly now extinct, that goes on living in my mother's and father's voices, if nowhere else. I think of how my parents got here, of everything they had to suffer, not just the painful but inevitable losses that come with having lived a long, full life, the death of parents, relatives, nearly all of the friends who once sat around that kitchen table, but the unnatural devastations too, the breast cancer that killed their daughter in 1995, the brain cancer that killed their son a few years later. I think of the unthinkable, what it would be like to bury one of my own children, and I'm amazed my parents have gotten here at all. What could possibly have held their lives together in the face of so much shattering? My mother stares me down, her one remaining child, and says again, in case I didn't hear the first time, "So? How far do you have to go that you have to listen?" Not far at all, I want to tell her, but I know it's not an answer that she wants. She wants I should only take the keys. So I do. In the early 70s, I went to Dublin when I graduated college. And my trip there, talk about having the troubled gene, my trip there coincided with the last terrorist bomb to go off in Dublin. and it was, it's unclear even today whether it was the IRA or the British who were setting up the IRA who set off the bomb, but it went off near the Trinity Library. And I at the time was there, you know, I was on my own. I had a scholarship from school I graduated from Brandeis University, and I was there just reading poetry. And I was in the library reading 16th century poetry, Sir Thomas Wyatt, and I don't know whether I was reading this particular poem when the, you know, when the bomb went off and the window shattered, but it was, you know, "They flee from me that sometime did me seek, with naked foot stalking in my chamber. I have seen them gentle, tame, and meek, who now are wild and do not remember that once they put themselves in danger to take bread at my hand, but now they range, busily seeking with a continual change." And there's a wonderful moment in that poem, when this wonderful seduction moment, when the loose gown from the shoulders falls, and she me caught in her arms long and small, and therewith all sweetly did me ask, "Dear heart, how like you this?" So that line, "Dear heart, how like you this," sort of appears in the poem. And the poem is inspired by that memory, which was occasioned by our justifiable preoccupation with terrorism today. And again, in a way, it's a poem about what is the place of poetry, the kind of safety and beauty and projection of a kind of civilized mental posture that poetry both that is the soul of poetry. What place does it have in a world of dirty bombs and dirty politicians? So the poem's called Old War, and this is the last poem I'm going to read. Where is the bower? Inside what book? Beside which window? in an ancient city I went to more than 30 years ago. Where is the bower, the bright mesh made from the names of flowers I, beyond the page, could not identify? Where is the bower, the loosened tress, the laugh, the eager rustle of the hand that slips the thin strap from the willing dress? And as it falls, the dear heart, how like you this plain courtesy of wanting what is wanted when it is. And when the bomb exploded and the window shattered in a silver shower as oddly pretty as any in the bower, a silver shower showering red over the words that told how birdsong answered birdsong everywhere overhead. And everyone who could was running while the bloody page went fluttering out into the city where the old war raged. Where was the bower? And where is it now? And how do I get back to where the dress is falling, but not yet on the ground? Thank you very much.